We'll work on it, but we don't know that we're going to see that again. Okay, the first speaker that we have here, just to welcome us this morning, is Jim Birchfield, the Associate Dean of the UM College of Forestry and Conservation. He's got experience as a rural sociologist and a forester, and his major interest centers on how people reside and interact with forests and grassland settings. He worked for the Forest Service for a number of years, and he also spent 3 years as a Peace Corps volunteer in a small rural village in northern Guatemala. Jim?
Thank you, Jim, and please take your time settling in. I'm just kind of the transition person to this wonderful group of panelists, and more than anything else, I just want to welcome you here to Missoula and the University of Montana. As an administrator here on campus, it's an enormous pleasure to be able to work in a place where something like the environment and the management and protection of nature is a really big deal. Not only our faculty, but faculty across campus think and work and teach about the protection of nature, about how we as human beings can coexist on this planet in a sustainable manner. And I think, and many of us I know write and believe, that this is the greatest human challenge. Among us are people who have been working in this field for many years, and I want just to offer you my deepest respect for all that you have offered to us to work on this challenge, and to tell you that we here in Montana not only believe that we can be a model for the type of human behavior that can sustain these beautiful and valuable resources, but that we need the solidarity of not only ourselves, but of all the people that you reach through your work. I must admit that it's important to people in Montana because the environment is important to people in Montana because they read about it every day. They see it on the news. They talk about it amongst themselves. They experience it firsthand. And the more capable you are of being able to deliver that message, to be able to bring forth ideas and science and the facts, I think the more able we're going to be to try to face these challenges. We have the wonderful opportunity to work with a remarkable faculty here on the University of Montana campus, and I'm proud to be a member of that group. One of them, you have a very special treat to hear today, Dr. Steve Running, who shared in the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize for the work with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is here to talk. He's been here since 1979. He actually started out as a plant physiologist teaching, you know, basic forestry and realized, my goodness, you know, this is a system. I've got to be able to figure out these biogeochemical cycles and use remote sensing, and has vaulted himself into a position of national and international leadership. And one thing about Steve is one thing I'm sure you'll notice about many Montanans is this sense of humility in the face of nature. Steve is someone you can approach and talk to, and he's taken his science not just to the top journals and to intergovernmental panels and to all the way to the leaders who are trying to struggle with this issue of climate change, but he takes it to school kids and he takes it to citizen groups just like you do with your work. And so I think the highest calling of scientists is not only to do the science, but to communicate it. And this, in my view, is an alliance that we have with journalists and people who are professionals and being able to explain complex information. And so I just want to say to you on behalf of the University of Montana, thank you for your work and keep it up. Thank you very much.
I'm Ray Ring, another conference co-chair. I'm the local guy, meaning in Montana. I only live 200 miles away in Bozeman. I'm here to introduce the moderator of the panel today and the idea of the changing West. I'm an actor of change myself. I'm a senior editor of High Country News, a magazine and website that cover the American West as a region, and I'm an actor of change in my physical actions and other decisions I make. My wife and I quit our jobs and moved to Montana 16 years ago with our two young kids and without jobs here. That was kind of a risky move, and it's the kind of move many people are making in the West these days. We were looking for something different, and we found it. Montana is the fourth largest state, much bigger than most of the states you live in, and our biggest metro area is about 150,000 people, about the size of Concord, New Hampshire. We have little cities and small towns forded up on a vast landscape. That's changing to some degree. People are moving here. As Yogi Berra might say, everybody wants to move to Montana because nobody lives here. Other things we discovered when we moved here are that the weather is very difficult and it's hard to make a living here. But we discovered other things about Montana as well. There was no speed limit here when we moved here, and it was legal to drive with a gun on the seat beside you and open liquor between your legs. Those things have changed too to some degree. Unfortunately, many Montanans think. The whole West is changing as well. We're the youngest region, the fastest growing region. We don't have a lot of institutions that track and consider the West as a whole, as a region. One of those institutions is High Country News. Another institution tracking the West is the Bill Lane Center for the American West at Stanford. The Bill Lane Center does research and teaching about the West past, present, and future, really looking at the big picture. John Christensen, the moderator of our panel today, has been associated with the center since 2002, and he's been the director for a little more than a year. John's background is in environmental journalism and science writing. He's been doing that for more than 20 years before he came to Stanford. He's written for the New York Times, High Country News, Nature Magazine, a wide range of publications. He's also done PBS and public radio documentaries. He teaches courses on climate change in the West and the West's history. He does his own original research, reaches original conclusions. He's also fluent in Spanish, Portuguese, and French, something I didn't know about John until I researched more about him. I'm a friend of his, but I had to learn more about him to introduce him. He's lived and traveled extensively in other countries. And I did know this about him from visiting him. He rides bikes, and he plays guitar and sings, and he also tweets. I found out that he's done more than 2,000 tweets and has 529 followers. So he's a man of great repute. John?
Thanks, Ray. Thanks. Thank you. And I tweet at West Center, so hello to all the friends out there who I know through those conversations. I didn't bring my gun or my bottle, but it's very, very nice to be back in the real West, the West of local grass-fed burgers that I enjoyed last night, though it does go down well with a nice red from Napa. And another from Sonoma, and one from Walla Walla, too. And a dessert of local berries. Underneath this big sky that never seems to change, even as everything else does. The changing West is our theme, and it's an evergreen in journalism. But today, as we know, even the big sky is changing. And we'll hear from Steve Running about that. And it's changing how we think about everything else. Or does it? As we'll explore. We've got an amazing panel here. When I was a journalist, and oh, how it pains me to say that, because I still am in heart and practice from time to time a journalist, I depended on people like this to give it to me straight. People I could call up and who would tell me what was really going on, even if they didn't want to appear in the newspaper the next day, or if they did. Because there's a lot changing, and that's not always apparent on the surface. I'm going to give you some super short intros here. You're journalists, and this is the age of the interwebs. You can look them up. They have amazing backgrounds and history. Steve Running is an ecologist at the University of Montana and the go-to climate scientist focused on the consequences of climate change in the West. Charles Wilkinson is a law professor at the University of Colorado, and you could not ask for a wiser, more simpatico guide to the long and deep and deeply rooted view of the changing West. Rebecca Miles is the first woman elected to be chairman of the Nez Perce tribe, and the youngest chairman ever at 32. She's now the executive director of the tribe. Say hello to the changing West. And Leslie Weldon, say hello to the changing forests of Risen the West. Regional forester for the northern region now. That's covering Idaho, Montana, North Dakota. 14 forests, I think, and 4 national grasslands, and has come up through the ranks from one of my favorite places, starting in one of my favorite places in the West, Mount Baker, Snoqualmie, which I was wonderful to have the opportunity to climb last year. And Greg Schildwachter, our final panelist, is not Dirk Kempthorne. And I want to thank Greg for stepping in. And with all due respect to the governor and former Secretary of the Interior, we got the best deal. Greg has worked for Governor Kempthorne on endangered species advisor. He worked for Senator Mike Crapo on the Senate Subcommittee for Fish, Wildlife, and Water, and was the associate director of the CEQ in the Bush White House, having the same portfolio of lands, water, and wildlife. And Greg is a conservative conservationist, a straight shooter, and like all of our panelists, a great source. All right, we're going to start with Steve Running giving us this big view of climate change. So much of environmental journalism and what we'll talk about is about people and politics. But all of it's about science, too. And we've asked Steve to paint a big picture for us with some data.
All right. No signal. That's a great start. There, we're getting somewhere. All right. What I'll do here just for about 10 minutes or less is zoom right into the climate trends we're seeing in the West. I'm certainly not going to give an audience like this the standard overview of global change science. I don't think you need that. Let's see what we as scientists think we know about the Western climate trends right now. Next slide. Hit it again. There we go. In this part of the country, really, like most of the country, the average annual air temperature has gone up on the order of 1 to 2 degrees Fahrenheit. And so this is really not a great deal different than the overall trend we see throughout the continental United States. Next slide. Probably the most interesting temperature metric that we've identified around here, though, is that our absolute minimum temperatures in the winter have warmed up substantially. Now, if you drive from here to Great Falls, you go past a sign that says the coldest point in the lower 48 states, the coldest temperature ever recorded, 70 below zero. That happened, I think, 50 or 60 years ago. Well, nothing like that happens now. And, in fact, this is a graphic for Missoula here about the number of days per decade that our temperatures go below zero Fahrenheit. And you see that for 60 or 80 years, we averaged about 10 nights a year below zero. And those we would reach temperatures of minus 20, minus 25, an occasional minus 30. Now we have maybe 2 or 3 nights per year that barely dip below zero a few degrees. And so you look at that from a climatology point of view, and we're looking at an increase in these absolute minimum temperatures on the order of 15 degrees. A far cry different than these 1 or 2 degree average increases we see in overall annual averages. So these winter temperatures are coming way up, and maybe that's why so many people are moving here. I don't know. Next slide. Now, a consequence of winter temperatures coming way up is that we are now seeing our winter snowpack start to melt a couple of weeks earlier than we used to. Long time ago, they chose April 1st as the time to measure the snowpack because that was typically the highest snowpack for the year. And to schedule irrigation and water management, they wanted those April 1st snowpack data. Well, this graphic shows for the Northwest how much lower our April 1st snowpack is than it was 50 years ago. And if you can see the graphic, you can see throughout the Northwest on the order of 30 to 40% lower snowpack on April 1st compared to 50 years ago. Next slide. What I find most important in assembling these pieces of information on our Western climate is to look at what I call the net water balance. And that's the difference between the rain and snowfall coming into the system and the evaporation rate coming out of the system. And particularly potential evaporation is really just a measure of humidity and the evaporating power of the atmosphere. Well, in this graphic, which actually is data we don't have published yet, so don't anybody copy this verbatim, we looked at precipitation trends from 1983 to 2006, potential ET, and the final balance. And this really shows that throughout the West, we are slowly aridifying. We're heading towards a more arid climate overall. Next slide. Now, when you aridify a climate like the Western United States, a likely consequence is more wildfire. And sure enough, that's been documented quite well in a number of research papers, most famous one by Tony Westerling in Science in 2006, that quantified our fire season is now on the order of 2 months longer. In California, they now consider that they have virtually a year-round fire season. And even in Billings, Montana, we had a wildfire on January 8th, a couple of years ago, the dead of winter, and there was a wildfire burning in Billings. And so we have clear evidence that the wildfire dynamic of the West has accelerated a lot in the last 30 years. Next slide. Now, another ecosystem impact that I've identified and we've looked at specifically, and another paper that's just in review now, is looking at the low flow of our streams in August, not the annual flow that most hydrologists seem to evaluate, but looking at how low is the lowest flow at the end of the summer. And you see for all those rivers, the trend for every single river is down on the order of 30 to 40%. Now, we have to recognize that is not all climate. That's a combination of irrigation withdrawals and climate trends. But from the point of view of the aquatic ecosystem, the trend is very obvious. We're dewatering our rivers right now at a very alarming rate. Next slide. The other really visual impact that we're seeing right now is really massive, unprecedented levels of mountain pine beetle in this area and other insect epidemics in forests to the west. And this epidemic started actually up in British Columbia probably a decade ago. And it's been skipping around the West. It got to Colorado before it got to Montana. And this map shows from a paper 2 years ago that we're seeing this trend throughout the West all the way up into Canada of insect epidemics that are 5 to 10 times larger than we've ever seen before. And moving into forests that never had these kind of epidemics. So right around Missoula, you see a lot of standing dead forests just from the last 2 or 3 years from this epidemic. Next slide. And a point I I find it's kind of a theoretical point, but I hope it's easily understood in principle, is that ranges we think of having carrying capacities. You put too many cows on a range and they're all skinny because none of them get enough to eat. Well, it's the same principle with forests. If there's too many trees on a forested landscape, and especially as the climate aridifies, you have a bunch of skinny, stressed trees that none of them got enough to eat this morning. And I'm afraid that's an overall assessment of what's happening to our forest. Next slide. I got two more. Future. Good. We have to get to the future. You've heard the present. What we're expecting from the GCM simulations of future climate for the Pacific Northwest, I show this illustration, is that particularly in the summer, it's going to be 4, 5, 6 degrees warmer and even less precipitation than we get now. So the climate models for our region also are suggesting this trend of aridification that we're already seeing in the historical data set. Last slide. And so my summary, particularly for Montana, but it really is, I think, accurate for most of the interior Rocky Mountains particularly, is that we are going to be running out of water at a rate even faster than we had before. I mean, the water wars in the West are probably going to reach a new level. Done.
Wow. That was, I hope you all appreciate how much information was packed into that. That's one of the very, very high level briefing in I think just under 10 minutes. Amazing. Yeah, thank you. So now I want to ask Charles Wilkinson, to also, to give us briefly a big picture view. I was rereading two books preparing for this that were written nearly 20 years ago. One was Beyond the Mythic West. Another was A Society to Match the Scenery. And there was a lot of talk in those days about the lords of yesterday and the changes that we've seen in power in the West. Where are they and where are we now? And what does that tell us in the face of what Steve's just shown us?
Thanks for the good news, Steve. I have a number of valued friends and colleagues here, and I've heard of this conference for years, and it's really a pleasure to be here, and I thank you for having me. I realized yesterday that our best places are often really compelling landscapes where you are entwined with experiences of family and friends. And Missoula is that kind of place for me. I've been up here a lot and learned a lot, and so it's kind of a double pleasure to have this occasion be here. We'll be talking about a number of changes in the West over these days specifically, but I'd like to mention an overarching notion of experience and thought that has perhaps laid the foundation for these changes. Until about two generations ago, we conceived of the West in traditional terms, the economy and society, in terms of timber and mining, grazing, ranching, commercial fishing, in the Pacific Northwest. And it was monolithic in that way. We had some writing about the beauty of the West, but not so much about society and economy and land intertwining. And, for example, in the South, which really had this period of analysis of angst about what their values and future were, we hadn't done that. And starting in the 60s, maybe more specifically in the 70s and 80s, we began doing that in serious ways. and a whole lot of new information and new views came to the West. The Western writing in this generation and just before has been extraordinary. Wallace Stegner, Ivan Doig, Terry Tempest Williams, Sherman Alexie, Gretel Ehrlich, others. Bill Kittredge is from here, right in this area where a lot came out of in Montana. And Kittredge grew up on a ranch in the Warner Valley in the high arid country, the big country of eastern Oregon. And the family's grazing leases on BLM extended way farther beyond where you could see. And he wrote a book called Owning It All. And he said that they thought they owned it all, but they were wrong. Not only did they not own it, but it would be wrong for them to own it because nobody could own it. Look at the proliferation of nonprofits. And I am not just thinking of environmental groups, but groups that work for communities and work for the land in many different ways, bringing in ideas and seeking social change. And journalism has been critical. In some cases, it's been people who identify as environmental journalists, but in other cases, it's just been journalists covering environmental matters. I do think that High Country News has played a central role and has been useful to all of us in this room, I would guess. What came out of this was, of course, not a rejection of the old economy completely, but what did come out of it was a reverence for open space and wildness that did not exist before. And we have tried to reach results by cooperation and consensus. And there's a lot more of it than we commonly realize. And I want to give one very brief example and then turn it over to my colleagues that I hope makes the point. The original Wilderness Act had 9.1 million acres put away in wilderness. The wilderness system is now almost 13 times larger, 110 million acres, 5% of the United States of America. Half of that is up in Alaska. And the Alaska lands, as you know, just can't be said to have come really from a consensus. There was a large dispute over that. But most of the additional wilderness system, I'm going to say all of it, went through Congress by consensus. People disagreed at the beginning, but they worked out their disagreements, and wilderness went through in a consensus way. And we have put into wilderness status over that period of about 2.5 generations an area the size of the state of Washington. And we see it in other places, as I think other people will relate.
Rebecca Miles, when you became the first woman, and at 32, the youngest elected chair of the Nez Perce tribe, you faced a lot of hard challenges. It was 150 years since the treaty was signed. What were and are the big challenges for the tribe in this changing West?
Thank you very much. First, I must say what an honor it is to be here speaking with such a great captive audience. And I think the tribe and tribes in general have had a very very good step up by having great environmental journalists. And then on this panel, some of my friends, and I think I would be working with Leslie Moore if I was still a policymaker for the tribe, but I've worked with Dr. Schildwachter and then became good friends here with somebody who I have admired as a young person as well on behalf of Indian Country. When I came on as the chair, as a policymaker, the tribe had just resolved its negotiations that were in private over the Snake River Basin adjudication. And you will never see a water settlement, under the Snake River Water Rights Act like that again in Congress, especially after the wonderful, enlightening news about our future water supply that we have. You will never see a tribal water settlement to that magnitude as well with those types of in-stream flows that the tribe secured over almost a 20-year period since the adjudication began on the Snake River. When I came in, I was the only woman on the council, and it was a very turbulent year because of the Snake SRBA. The negotiations were winding down. The tribe was then faced with making one of the biggest decisions it's made since treaty time, and one of the biggest decisions I hope the tribe will make in 100 years. Any big issues the tribe's been involved since then does not magnify to the level of our water rights settlement. And it's important for you to understand in this changing West and how tribes assert their rights and their power and their management over these natural resources, you have to understand the very legal foundation, especially in the context I will talk with just the Nez Perce. When I was thinking about coming over here, I was thinking all the lands the Nez Perce used to travel, and ownership was definitely a different ideal than what ownership we had at the time of when the West began to change. And I think of the Lewis and Clark expedition and what had happened at the time. That was the first non-Indian people that the Nez Perce have ever seen. And their role of the, you know, their famous expedition, you know that it was very critical among the Nez Perce that they actually could have ended their journey at that moment. No doubt the Nez Perce probably would have been annihilated after that, but nonetheless, that was a critical point in their journey. From that time, which is a very short window of our history, of tribal history, even human existence, you see a vast change of the West. You see now the balancing of resources versus interests. And that's really at the heart of what tribes face right now. At the time, 50 short years later, after the Lewis and Clark expedition, Isaac I. Stevens came because of the emerging, the settlers coming out to the West. It's time to now negotiate with those tribes a treaty. And if you read the 1855 treaty, and if you read the subsequent treaties after that, you will know what is extremely important to tribes. And you will also get an understanding when you look at the interests that we battle today, public interests, you look at power interests versus the resources and rights of tribes, it's important to understand how those rights were established. When the 1855 treaty came, tribes did not inherit rights. They retained rights they had since time immemorial. And they actually, our leaders at the time, had to make a tough decision, life or death, to lose all those rights, lose all those usual and accustomed areas that they lived, and come onto a reservation and lose those rights completely, and then retain those rights on the reservation. Not even before the 1855 treaty was ratified by Congress, the gold rush happened on the reservation in the Wiat Prairie area, and settlers, and there's major history out there now of the tours you can take, violated the treaty and came on the reservation. U.S. government came again and said, we cannot protect you. We need to put you on a smaller reservation. So the Nez Perce tribe retained all of its rights in the 1855 treaty, which cover a land base of three states, including rights that exist here in Montana. And so it's important to know that when you look at tribes' activity today in the Nez Perce tribe, you look at the Snake River Basin adjudication had everything to do with the 1855 treaty, because of the fishery right that the tribe had and retained at that time. So fish need water, and they have to have water in all seasons. And so the tribe had to claim enough water to sustain those fisheries in all seasons. Well, in the state of Idaho, you're going up against the lower four Snake River dams, and you're going up against major irrigation interests. And so you look at what is an inherent right, a legal right, versus the need that hasn't established its legal right, so to speak. And so those will constantly, now that you see the emerging of the lessening of the resources, you're going to see this constant fight over the breadcrumbs emerge year after year after year when it comes to water, when it comes to any resource. For example, Greg would be aware of the gray wolf discussion when he worked for the Governor Kempthorne at the time. And you'll see the resource versus the modern day hunting, those types of issues. And tribes get into those issues constantly. But it's important for you to understand tribal rights and how they became about. They are retained rights, inherent, and most of the rights actually were lost in understanding the discussion that we're going to have. So thank you.
Leslie Welton, the federal government and the Forest Service are a big presence in the West. And as I was rereading again some of these things about the myth of the West, one of the myths that they talked about needing to sort of break down is this myth of the great green big block of the federal government in the West, of the federal lands in the West, that they're actually, it's all mixed up. You're right next to communities. You've got checkerboard. You've got BLM. You've got tribes. There's all these players. Give us a picture of what it's like to be a regional forester right now in that mixed up landscape.
Thank you. And it is really great to be here and really wonderful to have such a full audience. And thanks to the University of Montana for being willing to host this. It's a very special event for Missoula and for this part of the country. So I'm in my 28th, going on 29th year in the Forest Service, and in my first year of being back in this region as regional forester. I left about 14 years ago from a district ranger position on the Bitterroot Forest down the valley there. And as I was leaving then, 14 or 15 years ago, there was quite a bit of change going on and happening that really portended a lot for the future. And when I think about that, there's two words that I have had then as I was leaving that I also have now. Great challenge, but also great opportunity. I think the things that are really coming into play, just like you've heard about these other sort of progressions and maybe rapid evolutions as far as what it really takes for us as citizens, the federal government as basically agents for millions and millions of acres of public land on behalf of all citizens, is really this coming together of people and what these lands truly mean. It's not, when I look back at our history over the last 100 years or so in the West, the progression that we've made, I think, is logical in a way, and it's mirrored quite a bit in other nations that, in the developing world, for example, are moving into stages that we've already moved through. But this idea of really looking around and saying, what is it that we want to ensure that we can sustain, and the we in the West, like we had in our introductory panel, is very few people, but very few people who are very intensely connected to the landscapes that they have. So what is it that we need to do to ensure that we are perpetuating and sustaining these values that we look around and see are more incredible and carry so much weight than we ever thought? When we hear about the changes that are coming our way, and actually that we've been in the midst of for a very long time, it really causes us to pause and think differently about what we need to do for the future. So it is about trying to achieve the balance. And mentioning about this juxtaposition of so many different interests on landscapes, both from the standpoint of direct ownership and access, empowerment, the role of so many tribes in that very formal, very clear relationship, especially with the federal government, the thing that I'm seeing and recognizing is that the ability to work across those boundaries and to really take into consideration all the contributions that, you know, a Plum Creek, as it's looking at divesting in lands here, can make the choice to say, rather than having these lands go into development, we will in turn say, how can we make this part of public ownership? How can the checkerboard that's there in the future contribute to some more connected landscapes over the large scale areas, but also long-term into the future? So the ability for those types of things to come up to stimulate a lot of engagement, discussion about values is extremely important. So this track that we're on with the National Forest, with the grasslands, with the Bureau of Land Management and the Park Service here, as well as agencies like the Natural Resources Conservation Service and all of our ag agencies, is to really find ways from internal government perspective and our responsibilities, be it assistance to communities or just outright, you know, scientific and management expertise on managing lands, to build those connections and partnerships with folks outside. And since 14 years ago, you know, this idea of opportunity and challenge, I was very pleased to come back and see amazing progression from when I left of folks saying, you know, can we find ways to agree about any of this? And the answer mostly being it's going to be extremely hard, to now where more and more people from outside the Forest Service are being those conservation leaders within their communities, within the organizations that they represent, to say, not ask the question, but say, we must. We must find ways to be able to work together in light of what we value here, what we, as people who are local and adjacent to those lands, can provide by way of leadership and support that in turn, especially for the public lands, can make a difference for citizens everywhere. This myth of the West thing, where so many people who perhaps never come here but have the understanding and the knowledge of the vast resources, be it wilderness, be it, you know, large swaths of very unique, high quality aquatic and terrestrial environments, they're there. And in a way, you know, we need to make the myth a little bit more of a reality and a little bit more of a shared responsibility, but that folks in the West, by coming together and working together, can really perpetuate that. So I still carry a sense of challenge and optimism, and I'm feeling much more optimistic about what the possibilities are for people coming together to, you know, do what we need to do as far as being able to sustain the lifestyles that people have here. If you look at public lands, they mean so many things to different people, with recreation really growing significantly, but also to restore and make these landscapes resilient in the face of the climate change that we're in the midst of.
So. Well, we come a long way from Steve's presentation to your optimism. Greg Schildwachter, how about you as a conservative conservationist looking out at this changing landscape, the midterm election coming up and all of that? I mean, in this context, what do you see as the major challenges and opportunities from your perspective?
First of all, thanks for having me. Congratulations on 20 years. That's an important milestone for your organization. And, you know, I just got to begin by saying this place has always fascinated me, the West, by how it flowers the closer you get to it. You know, when you enroll here as a student and you start to learn this ecosystem, you know, right on this hill, right out here, and you figure out, as I had to do coming from Texas and Georgia before that, you know, what a service berry is and what a snowberry looks like, it gives you this sense of richness that belies the sort of arid, you know, blanket look that it would have at a distance. So it just strikes me that as we've covered a lot of territory just already with these co-panelists, I'm having a similar sort of a feeling about how rich a place this is and how much I appreciate it. I could get emotional about it, which I think makes some of the points. Not for nothing, I was mountain biking up on that hill once, and a little too ambitiously. Just as I was going backside over tea kettle, one of the last things I saw was a snowberry, and I knew it was a snowberry. my message, my answer to your question, John, is the great reason for optimism, which is mainly what I see, is that the partisan divide over the issues that concern us, the issues that you all, I think, at the top of your craft, pick up and look at with that same specificity as a taxonomist would identify a snowberry or a serviceberry. The partisan divide over those issues is narrowing. Leslie just referred to it there at the end of her comments. Having been in the Bitterroot 14 years ago, and then coming back, she would have seen she has about the same sampling frame that I do. It was about that long ago that I was here, and my job was to work on national forest projects in a consensus manner. So I'll come back to that, but let me give you a few. We don't have good numbers to back up my argument, because the environment, generally speaking, politically, and you got to remember, too, I started as a wildlife biologist, and I got sucked into the marbled hallway, so I'm a little bit irreverent about some of the dark arts back there, but by far not an expert on them. But the numbers, the polling numbers and so forth, just don't really populate as much for this kind of an argument, because the environment still really is an incidental part of American politics. It's not a driver. It's always there if you need an anvil to throw to a drowning candidate. it's always there to polish an aspiring candidate. But it's not a driver, so we don't have good numbers. But I think we can characterize the argument in the following ways. Wilderness. Wilderness issues now, there's legislative proposals pending. There have been a couple of big omnibus lands bills, I think, that make Charles's point, that people are coming together and figuring out locally how to divvy up the landscape around their community into wilderness and recreation lands. Just due south of here, if you go through the Bitterroot Valley, you get down into the central Idaho country of the Boulder White Clouds, and there's a bill pending. It's been in development for about 10 years that would do that. In the last omnibus lands bill signed, one of the first bills signed by President Obama, the Owyhee Initiative of southern Idaho was part of that. And you know, these are deals that reconcile some pretty disparate interests. Interests you could barely get in the room 14 years ago together. Motorized use, wilderness, so forth. So I think that's one example. Another example is forestry. My good friend Tom France runs the Office of the Wildlife Federation here, and I walked by their front door yesterday when I got into town, and was proud to see the poster he has there on his front door, advocating for the Montana Forest Jobs and Recreation Act, which is a legislative proposal, and there are similar ones in Oregon that Senator Wyden is pushing, and in Colorado that Senator Udall is pushing, which have as their common element a legislated requirement for the Forest Service to act and carry out management. And again, reconciling two pretty disparate interests, the forest businesses, what remains of that industry here, and recreation of a broad variety. Another example I would give you of the narrowing of the partisan divide is a couple of things that Rebecca mentioned. She mentioned the Snake River Water Rights Act. That was very difficult to negotiate. I was proud to be there to help push it over the finish line when it needed to get congressional approval. And, you know, hugely impressed by Rebecca's ability to get council approval for that. I mean, historic deal. I think it's worth mentioning. But I want to mention the Columbia River power system issue, though, more to my point, because that issue, of course, has been pending for years and years, and it's been wrapped up in endangered species litigation. But in the transition of the administration, the deal survived. The last deal that we were able to put together, again, for which, you know, people like Rebecca were indispensable It survived the transition. There was some patina that was put on it, I think, through the judge. You know, God help us, the judge wasn't done, you know, putting his imprimatur on it. But he could not find a way to remand it again. And the new administration, you know, they did an adaptive management implementation plan sort of a thing. But the essential deal survived, and I think that's a testament to the narrowing of the divide.
Let me just mention
a couple of examples. We got to talk about wolves on this. Another issue that bridged the transition. We got to talk about hunting and fishing. And John, at some point, I'd like to come back to the issue of process. I was stunned to hear Charles say that the congressional act, you know, the congressional action creating wilderness is an example of consensus building, and I think we need to talk about that.
Uh-huh. Well, Steve, and I want to get you all involved in this conversation. So as you're thinking about questions, well, I think we'll open it up earlier rather than later and ask for this next round of questions to be sort of lightning questions so we can move more quickly. And I want to, so if you'd like to come up and ask some questions at the microphone, as before, please identify yourselves and keep the questions short, and we'll keep this lively and moving. Steve, while people are coming up, I want to ask you, is this optimism infectious, listening to these stories about people and politics in the changing West? You still think we're doomed?
Well, one of the things that I think we as climate scientists, after, of course, our big 2007 report, came to the conclusion of is that simply quantifying more scientific graphs is no longer the central moving point of this issue. That we really now have to engage all of society in deciding priorities and choices of what we're going to do. In order to really ultimately stabilize the climate, we're going to have to rebuild society in such a fundamental way over a long period of time, 50 to 100 years, that I now in my public lectures talk as much about sociology as I do about climate.
Great. Is there someone who wants to jump in among the journalists at this point?
Hi, I'm Tom Morton with the Casper Star Tribune. Y'all are talking about getting closer and the things are getting more consensus-y. Wolves.
Is that a word? Consensus-y?
Yeah.
Like it.
Yeah.
I knew that's where the way I was.
That's cooler. It's cooler than truthiness, actually.
Consensiness.
Anyway, I'm from Wyoming, so, like, how do you explain this stuff with wolves? I would be thrilled to see. I've covered that stuff a lot, and I don't see it.
Yeah, and this is, I'm really glad you asked that. My point was that the partisan divide was closing. And so in the case of the wolf issue, what I would point you to is the fact that the delisting rule, now defunct, was issued by the prior administration and was supported by the subsequent administration. So I'm talking partisan politics, capital P, who's in the seats and what party do they represent. The current administration is going to the mat on the delisting rule. They filed last Friday their petition of appeal with the other defendants in the case, and so you know they're going to push through to the extent of that litigation, you know, whether or not Judge Malloy got it right. All right, so I'm talking partisanship. So obviously there are widely disparate and violently disparate opinions about wolves among the people who are most directly affected by them in their daily life. But I still would point out a couple of things about that also point toward a narrowing. All three states have a wolf management plan. Now, the legal problem has to do with the fact that the federal government will not acknowledge the Wyoming state plan. But if you go and talk to the wolf scientists, talk to Ed Bangs and ask him, as a Wolf plan, I won't speak for him, but ask him, would it work? I mean, would you be able to sustain a wolf population with this plan? And you know, he'll say yes.
So, and the plan is to, the plan being to take the wolf off of the endangered species list. That's what you
right.
mean by delisting. And Rebecca, you found yourself in this issue too. What's the tribe's perspective?
Well, we are, as you are aware, in Idaho, at the time that Idaho was being, was requested to have the wolf reintroduced and declined, that the Nez Perce tribe did step up and worked with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and did an outstanding job managing and reintroducing the gray wolf in Idaho. Idaho has since taken that from the Nez Perce tribe, and now we have to get our relationship through the state of Idaho. We do have fundamental differences in the management. We have kind of stepped back from this delisting argument because we may think we're a little bit closer than some of the real violent issues in other states. We do have a difference of opinion on the harvesting, and we do have a management plan for harvesting. Harvesting of wolves does occur in the state of Idaho. We do have a very different...
And by harvesting, you mean shooting.
Shooting them. And that is just not part of our culture. It's not part of our history. And so we do have a lot of issues with Idaho Fish and Game on our consultation meetings about what the Nez Perce chooses to do with its tags. And we have some, because the wolf was so revered in our history, it's in many of the chiefs' names. There's a sense of, you know, another sovereign can't tell another sovereign, well, this is what you're going to do with your management part of the piece. And so it's gotten a little bit difficult, but we're way further than we were 5-10 years ago to even get to the point of not fighting the state on the harvest issue because of the recovery efforts have been so successful.
So was there someone else who wanted to step in? And I'm sure that this conversation about the wolves will go on throughout this conference, and there may be some special panels on that.
I'm Tony Davis from the Arizona Daily Star down in Tucson. On the subject of water and consensus, how do you folks think the coming aridity and the continued aridity that Dr. Running was talking about is going to affect the politics of water in the West? Will there be more divisiveness, more lawsuits, or do you think people are going to sit down and say, we can't do it this way, we have to reach agreement, we've got to work this out? Which do you see as the most likely scenario?
Charles, you want to take that one? And as we were talking at one point about some of the examples coming out of the Northwest that you see.
Well, I'll just say, and it's a good question. To me, we have not yet really started to incorporate information about global warming into our natural resource decisions. And the Secretary of Interior has clearly said the debate's over. And I think that's widely held throughout the federal agencies. But we haven't really started to implement it yet. And here's the thing. It's the overriding issue for all of our careers, climate change in the environment. That's the number one issue, and it's going to be. And so we're off to a very slow start, and we certainly are going to have to come around to it. And there are people in the agencies ready to go, but the politics are still deadly so far, I think. We're going to have to resolve this.
I was intrigued by a conversation we had earlier in which you suggested that maybe some of the lessons from the Pacific Northwest would be learned by other states about dam removal, about water, about in-stream flows, about NGOs, about tribes, about, you know, all these different ways. I mean, the issue is, as Steve pointed out, is not just global warming, but it's what's taken out of the river.
Well, I think that's a good point. And I mean, we still haven't been able to assimilate the significance of the dam removal. I mean, we've got now the Elwha dam is really, both of them are going to start coming out probably in the next year. And you've got the White Salmon Dam is out, Savage Rapids Dam is out, and then you've got this extraordinary settlement on the Klamath River that I think everyone knows about, I hope. That is the largest dam removal project in the history of the world. And tribal scientists were in the forefront, by the way, of putting that through. It was a tremendous... you talk about coalitions. You have everybody from commercial fishers, all the state representatives of federal and state, all the way up to the irrigators up in Oregon and the tribes, and environmental groups got together on that. And so, but here's the thing. There aren't salmon in the interior west, or in most of the interior west.
But they're trout.
They're trout. But trout aren't salmon. And
for some people, trout are important.
Listen. I've got credentials on trout, so I'm okay on that score. But I am saying this, that salmon is an icon to society in the Pacific Northwest, that there really is no other species we have that is like that. There aren't salmon jokes. You know, the world was filled with spotted owl jokes. There aren't salmon jokes. And so it is hard to take that into the interior west outside of salmon country. It is not as compelling to the society as a whole. We're going to see talk about taking out dams, including talk about Glen Canyon Dam, but that's real early in that development. Yeah.
I'm Karen Schaefer, former public radio journalist, now independent radio producer. As someone who grew up in northern Colorado and now lives in the water-rich Great Lakes region in Ohio, what really strikes me about coming back to the West is the population explosion of people. I was in northern Colorado a couple of years ago, and I couldn't believe the Front Range cities. They've exploded. I hear from folks here that Missoula has grown rather dramatically, and I'm sure some other cities in Montana have too. My question, you know, back in the East, we've got cities that are shrinking. Out here, you've got cities that are exploding. Westerners traditionally haven't done much in the way of zoning, that awful Z word. How are Western states beginning to think about, or are they even beginning to think about, managing their human population?
Well, I think you've pointed out something. I mean, the West continues to be a rising power, and you know, in the United States, in terms of population, economy, GDP, exports and trades with Asia, and that's going to continue for this century. You know, we're going to get more representation in Washington, when we look at the data, there's a really interesting phenomena that happens, that conservation and ideas about economic improvement seem to go hand in hand. The states that are doing the best economically are often those states where the most conservation is also happening. I want to ask, Leslie, this is something that you have to deal with all the time in terms of the people moving into the woods. And that urban wildland interface and fires. How do you all think of that, and how do you interact with these, with these communities that may not have zoning?
There was a great field trip yesterday that many of you participated on, which had the group going up to a wildfire that was just outside of town here, the Black Mountain Fire. Which, you know, if you stood from here and looked over, you could see it, and homes were literally within less than half a mile of where the fire ended up stopping. Beautiful homes, you know, those idyllic places that folks want to live when they come to the West. What we have by way of a real challenge, not just within the Forest Service or any wildfire fighting agency, but with local communities, with counties, with state governments, is just trying to increase this understanding of the fact that we live in an environments throughout the West that are born of fire. We've put a hold on it for a while with our fire suppression strategies, and we're feeling the effects of that now, both from the standpoint of the changing climate that we're seeing, but also from the standpoint of the amount of ingrowth that's in those forests, and the fact that there's so many homes, people's homes that are now at that interface. Our highest fire costs in fighting wildfire occur at the well-in urban interface. It's a continuing challenge, but the progress that's being made, once again, is within the state governments and within the communities where people are stepping forward to say, we have to figure out how to live with fire rather than thinking that there's an entity like the federal government that is going to be there to defend you when the fire comes your way, because we can't be successful at that. So there's a huge need for education. There are a lot of great programs in place with the states, the FireWise program here in Montana, and especially when we have some of our political leaders like Governor Schweitzer here who, you know, will say directly to citizens, you need to help be part of the solution. We are still struggling with how, from a zoning standpoint, we can work on that. We're still struggling from an insurance standpoint on what might change there that would really influence us being more successful in ensuring that citizens who live in those urban interface areas can be safe. You know, part of it may be that we just shouldn't be building homes there, or we need to make very large investments in ensuring the security there. So that's an issue that I think we're making progress on once again, but at the same time, we're going to see much more development. There's only a fraction of opportunities for growth that we've taken that citizens have taken advantage of, and we're going to see much more wildfire.
Is there another? I've been told I should occasionally maybe explain this jargon. Although I think all of you probably know, urban wildlands interface. It's where people are building homes out in the forest edge.
Wooey, as I learned yesterday.
Wooey.
Wooey.
All right, that's a new one to me.
This is Tom Uhlsman from the Center for Environmental Journalism, and I've just asked this question to whoever wants to tackle it. Perhaps as early as in the next couple of days before this conference ends, Lake Mead may drop to historic low levels, and I'm wondering if anyone wants to address the significance of that event.
Steve, you want to take that on?
Well, I'll start by saying that my hydrology friends in Arizona don't expect Lake Mead or Lake Powell to ever fill ever again. So they don't in any way see we're going to get enough surplus water to refill those reservoirs. So that's the good news.
Greg?
Yeah, I would I would add that those of you who've worked the Southeast may have picked up on the reservoir issues on the ACF water system down there, the Chattahoochee River. So, I mean, these reservoir filling issues are not limited to the West. And I guess what I recommend is that you pay attention to the development of water trading. There are some programs here in the West. National Fish and Wildlife Foundation has one of them. BPA, I think, is supporting another one, Oregon State. But on the
Columbia River.
Yeah, but particularly, you know, find out what the legal phrase defense to forfeiture means if you don't already know, because what needs to change is, and what is starting to change, is the ability under state law to leave water in a stream and still retain that water right.
And this is going to be really key, and it's going to be also interesting to look at this across the states in the American West, because all the states have different policies. We have a project on water in the West at Stanford where we're looking at that, and these are some of the critical questions about how we go forward. And I think that this event is going to drive a lot of urgency in that conversation. Did you want to
just add a little? Yeah. You know, the last couple of questions really focused on the evidence that things are really changing with water. And Charles had made the comment about salmon being this iconic representation of healthy watersheds. And we need to find a way in the interior West, because there's
you know, the high mountains that we have here are the tops of watersheds. It's the places where that water starts and flows to so many different places. Back to the question about the interface, we have a big job to do in increasing citizens' understanding about the water cycle and what's at risk and what changes we'll see, and that it is something that's going to start showing up in front yards if Lake Mead's never going to fill again, if people are seeing the provocative statements that political leaders are making in the upper Midwest about who owns the water in the Great Lakes and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and as most of our water, particularly in California, is actually stored as snowpack.
In Colorado.
And as you know, Steve has said, that's going to be changing. I mean, looking also at the trading, storage and trading water and water markets using depleted groundwater aquifers as banks in which you can store and trade water. It's going to be another interesting thing to watch.
Barbara Bernstein, and I'm an independent radio producer in Portland and program host at Kibu Radio. I mainly want to ask a question about water, but before that, just one comment about land use and that unspeakable word in the West, zoning. In Oregon, we've had land use laws statewide for over 30 years, and we don't have the WUI problem to nearly the extent that is happening in the rest of the West. So just to throw out the idea that land use on a statewide level, land use regulations where you really limit development in farm and forest land works, and I think Oregon is a model of that. But
just to jump in, I mean, I think one of the questions I wanted to ask Charles, and maybe we'll take up, is why can't Western states learn from each other? But go ahead with that.
Okay, but I'm actually mainly concerned about water issues, and I heard a little bit of mention about the four dams on the Snake River, and I don't believe that there's really a consensus around that. But I wanted to ask about like, where is that going? And I know that even amongst the tribes now that there has been a disagreement about whether those dams should go out. So mainly this is questions for Rebecca, and
sure.
Then Amy Bells wants to jump in.
Finally, those four dams. One of the things that I heard Greg mention, what you were noticing on the Federal Columbia River Power System, the FCRPS, and this holistic kind of agreement that has been reached among tribes and BPA and NOAA regarding the operations of the Federal Columbia River Power System. There is not one tribal leader out of all the tribes that have settled or signed an accord that was more involved than myself as a negotiator, involved directly with the administration in that agreement. Subsequently, the Nez Perce did not sign the agreement. For two reasons. One, we had just finished SRBA, so this 10-year agreement was not even to the magnitude of what we had just agreed to in the Snake River Basin adjudication. And we said in SRBA that we would focus on the main stem, the water issues there, and that's exactly what we did. The two reasons the Nez Perce chose not to is because the United States was asking us, one, to say that the actions of the power system met the Endangered Species Act, and two, that we would not lobby or work to get the four lower Snake River dams removed. And those are two things the Nez Perce would not say. In SRBA, very similar action. We agreed to the actions of flows for fish in certain times of the year, but we did not have to say in the agreement that those actions met the law. And so if you understand the tribal power is in the court system to protect its retained rights that I talked about earlier. And so we have always wanted to reach agreement. If you do not have the Nez Perce tribe in that battle, environmentalists are for it, but if you do not have the Nez Perce tribe there, that is right there as furthest inland to the furthest inland in the United States is the Port of Lewiston, you will not see that happen. You absolutely have to have the tribe in that involvement to help reach agreement. The tribe doesn't want to see economic devastation, but to take us out of that discussion altogether, I mean, the negotiations got down to wearing sandwich boards. You can't wear sandwich boards. So we thought, that's right. So we did not sign that agreement. And to our disappointment, there was a lot of other things hinged on that agreement for the FCRPS, those accords that are so famously known as billion-dollar accords, because there was a lot of funding involved that tribes were threatened with that wouldn't be able to manage their own fishery in a way that they felt best, like what's going on now with the Mitchell Act testimony on hatcheries. But I just wanted to say the discussion is kind of, I guess, in regards to the FCRPS, has died down to some extent while that settles. And the nature of that agreement is to get people back to work, to do something, get out of the courtroom, get on the ground work going, get something going for fish right now with all of those concerns. Low water issues. The tribes have always paid attention to the August year of every year forever, because that is the migration for juveniles. So it's a very key year that we key month that we protected in SRBA out of Dorshak to protect 2 weeks of water out of hottest year of the month.
So as you've just heard, this is a great introduction to the complexity of the issues, and I won't try to translate for the audience, you know, all of the acronyms that you used and the court cases and the policies, but it's very, very clear, I think, that that's how change happens.
Can I make a comment on that? And it has to do both with reform in water law and covering water law, which is that in the West, circumstances are such that you almost always have to go watershed by watershed or even sub-watershed by sub-watershed in terms of reform because, first of all, the systems are all state systems so that there are some important federal laws such as the Endangered Species Act, but basically water laws administered at the state level, water policy at the state level. And at the state level, the broad state policies aren't really what's most important and what is where most of the best work is being done now. It is on particular streams, particular rivers, and in some cases particular lakes. And so in order to cover it well, I mean, I think if you feel that you are covering a watershed issue, even though it may be a small watershed, you're probably making an important contribution because there are a lot of ideas about how to approach this, and we're all learning, and innovations are being made continually. In terms of Western states learning from each other, Oregon started Water Watch back in the 80s, and now every Western state has an environment, including this one, has an environmental office, most of them by Trout Unlimited, which do approach issues on a state level. Environmentalists have really been effective in water policy only in the last 5 or 6 or 7 years when they've begun to work in a really serious way at the state level. And the second institution is water trusts. Our first water trust was just 12 years ago in Oregon. And now that's spread around the West. And it's like a land trust. Instead of conservation easement basically for land, you're protecting in-stream flows. There's a lot of creativity, but it's extremely diffuse.
Well, this might be one of the interesting areas, and it's certainly one we're looking at, how can we learn watershed by watershed? I think this was first.
John, there's one other building point that I think is big picture and important after what Charles and Rebecca just said, and that is, it gets to the question about consensus and are we really getting anywhere if citizens are at war over wolves, for example, but, you know, presidents are agreeing. I mean, does that, you know, what does that matter? And the difference is when you're working at smaller scales, you're working within the laws, the Endangered Species Act and so forth, which have a lot of reopeners. There's citizen suit provisions. You know, there's NEPA, requirements, these analytical documents that are so easy to trip up a federal decision on and get a remand. But at the congressional or state legislative level, there are a lot fewer reopeners. And I know some people have observed that one of the beauties of our system of government is our ability to decide something even though we continue to disagree. So when you get a formalized decision, and you should notice there are bills now in Congress to solve this wolf issue from all Wolf State delegations. So as the partisan divide is narrowing, you have a chance of having a decision imposed in a way that is much more difficult to reopen than these decisions that we typically fight under the Endangered Species Act, which can get reopened all the time, which is why Rebecca has spent so much time in court. So this is an important, I think, a very important thing to keep your eye on, because if you start seeing consensus at a legislative level, either at the state level or Congress, you're going to start having some of these debates shut off, even though debate continues. And in some cases, that'll be a good thing.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Tali Nauman, and I'm going to ask this question in my capacity as a contributing editor to the Native Sun News based in Rapid City, South Dakota, for Rebecca Miles. Getting back to Stephen Renning's points in the beginning regarding the actual down-on-the-ground effects of climate change right now. For the tribal people, of course, there's much more immediate contact with resource issues such as the snow melt earlier and the stream levels being lower and the weakened trees. What have been some of the impacts that you've seen in the Nez Perce, and how can you use this government-to-government relationship established by treaties that you mentioned for taking steps to mitigate climate change? How's that?
That's one specific project that I think is working very well at a grassroots level and didn't get resolved in SRBA, the Snake River Basin adjudication, is the Lewiston Orchards Irrigation District. And that is exactly balancing what tribes had as two streams of water versus lessening snowpack versus diverting water out to get to Lewiston Orchards Irrigation and up to Man Lake that actually is no longer an irrigation district. And the answer, obviously, to the tribe is just get on the general Lewiston system, and we're going to help you do that to get water out of the Clearwater. But instead, this water is getting diverted from Craig Mountain. And I can tell you, since I was a young girl, I remember my grandparents even talking about the snowpack. And Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission talks about it now. They give the reports to the commissioners every month. They pay very close attention to the snowpack. That project itself has been litigated ESA-wise. But the on-the-ground work where we're consulting now with our delegation out of Idaho, our state representatives, our state lawmakers, our county commissioners, all by, I think, one gentleman who lives in the orchards who just wanted to see this get resolved, to, you know, 2 years into meeting where we're now going jointly together to seek funding for the major pump that will pump the water out of the Clearwater, that will be the amount of water the orchards needs in Lewiston will be insignificant to the flows. And so that's a global resolution to this huge problem of ESA listed species for salmon and steelhead in the Sweetwater and Lapway Creeks. And so that has been devastating. As a young child, you'd see the water flow to where there's nothing. I remember one of my cousins coming home saying, didn't we used to swim in that? And there's, you know, it's just barely flowing. And I said, yeah, but that's before you had this major, the lessening of the snowpack. So then you have less water, but you still have the same amount, if not more, being diverted over to get to Man Lake. So that has been a very, very positive project between all the stakeholders, whether you're a resident watering your grass in the orchards or you're from the tribe. It's been, and I'm looking forward to assisting our policy leaders in lobbying for that funding. It didn't get settled in SRBA, and I don't know why, because it was really close to getting settled in there, and then it just lost agreement for the wrong reasons, I believe. But that is one great question of coming together, all these different interests, irrigators, everything coming together on this issue.
Well, I know if we could. I would love to continue to talk all morning with all of you. And I know that folks will be around during the break if you'd like to talk with them about any of these issues.
as I said, they're great sources. We have time for one more quick question.
Oh, goodness, the pressure's on. My name's Erica Russo. I'm a freelance writer. My question is more of a cultural one. You know, as a room full of communicators, our maxim is to know our audience. And I'm wondering, when we talk about change, you know, Dr. Running, you mentioned the concept of caring capacity. Have you all witnessed a change, or are you optimistic about a change in the cultural receptivity in America to accept the idea that there is a caring capacity for people?
Anybody want to take
I'm
that one
optimistic.
On?
I'm optimistic.
You're optimistic?
You know. No.
Well, I just in general want to say that's a very great question. In one of my testimonies early on when I came on as the chair, I talked briefly about that. Because the West, and especially the Pacific Northwest, is seeing this big boom, it's important for, you know, these small towns, these tribes that have been here forever, and, you know, the people that have been here, to communicate the values. Because we have all these, you know, I talked to Steve Wright at BPA, the increasing, you know, the screen, the LED screen's going to get even bigger. We're going to see a 100-inch, you know, there's electronics are just going through the roof. And so this need for technology is increasing the need for power. So how are we balancing that with why people move out to the Pacific Northwest in general? You know, if you come from the Southwest, you think there's just an abundance of water. If you're from the Northwest, you know, Dr. Running's report is true. We're seeing less water than ever before. So how do you balance this, you know, this view of this is just wonderful out here to protecting its resource for, you know, the tribes always believed that is the very essence of our existence. If we don't take care of that resource, the gray wolf, the water, the salmon, then we can expect to see the same defeat that they are seeing now. And until we take that serious enough, and if we value, and I believe what we value in the West, we all value the same thing. We all value the beautiful scenery. We value our nature. We value the resource equally. And I think by coming together on that very issue, how do we protect it 50 years, 100 years from now?
Well, I want to end taking that cue about audiences and end with a thought about journalism and take this moment to make a short plug for if you pick up some information about our Center for the American West at Stanford, we offer fellowships, short-term fellowships for journalists working on Western environmental issues, and as well as a prize for the best Western environmental journalism each year, the Knight Risser Prize. And I want to ask our panelists, I mean, quickly, a very short minute, if you're looking out as a journalist in all the issues that we've covered, what's the top one that you would keep in mind to look at over the next several years? Steve?
Well, what I'm looking for is to see if we generate any international scale governance that allows us to really govern the carbon cycle in the way that we as scientists see it necessary, because right now we don't see any governance structure that's up to the task at all.
Greg? Number one issue, water. No question about it. You know, perhaps secondarily, I think, sort of process-wise, how are our conservation institutions going to deal with experts in the future, and are we going to figure out that conservation is actually a negotiation, or it begins with a negotiation, not with an analysis?
Leslie?
I'm agreeing about water. You know, if you look at a foundational role of open and wild lands, it's to sustain and produce that water for the long term. And if we're able to increase the amount of understanding among citizens, regardless of where they live along the gradient of a watershed, I think we put ourselves in a better position to really you know, grow towards the things that you've talked about as far as being able to secure that for the long term. And if I could, I just wanted to make a quick note. Dave Cleaves is here. He's the lead for Climate Change in the Forest Service.
He has his hand up over there.
Yes. Dave. Uh-huh. Yeah. And then also Ann Bartuska, who is actually Undersecretary USDA over all of research functions, both for natural resources and ag. And that's been a big focus within those programs. How do we promote the value of water among citizens and learn more about it?
Charles?
I think it's climate change, and water is part of that. And what I hope so much is that young people take climate change and the many different professional and other opportunities in it and really make it their cause. And I think to the extent any of us can help with that and by passing information on so that young people become inspired, as I think they are. They all had different kinds of education than we've had, and they're quicker to pick up on it. But I think it can be a very exciting time. Causes are sad, because if there's a cause, there's some serious problem that's really painful. And that's the way global warming is, but it is an opportunity for young people. We've all had causes, I think, and that can be a good thing. I want to make one thing clear. In Montana, salmon are iconic. I mean, trout are iconic. Iconic. They are iconic. In the Northwest, there's kind of a capital I aspect to it.
Yeah. Rebecca?
I would agree with Charles Wilkinson on climate change as being the biggest issue. And for tribes, I think specifically for this, for journalism, is understanding the role in that. There has never in the history of the Northwest or this country the better managers of any of the resource. I mean, for thousands of years it's been managed. And so now we're just catching on to this all-age approach, or this, you know, this sense of this holistic view. And I very much care about the tribe's role in a part of that discussion for 50 to 100 years to come.
So I want to end by talking about two institutions that I think are going to be really important to keep an eye on. One of them is the land-grant universities in the American West. And both of these things that I'm going to mention are in evidence right here. So, you know, are our universities in the West, and both of these were identified by Ed Marston maybe 20 years ago as important institutions for the West, the universities. The University of Montana is a great example, Steve's work, of how those universities are stepping up to address these challenges and help identify and create the solutions. The other one is journalism. We need great journalism in the West in order to understand these challenges and come and negotiate, understand where we're at, come up with solutions. And as all of you know, and I don't need to tell you, this is a very challenging time for journalism in the changing West. We've given six Knight Risser Prizes for Western Environmental Journalism over the last 6 years. Of those, two of the winners have seen their papers disappear out from under them. The other one has seen her investigative unit decimated. As Charles said, writers are important. Writers here in Montana, writers around the West, the journalists around the West, to continue to tell these stories, to continue to work, all of us together, the universities, the NGOs, journalists, to figure out how we can continue to ensure that great environmental journalism thrives in the American West. And so I would like to take this opportunity to ask, and I know my fellow panelists will join me in thanking you for being part of this changing West.